So what is the mind? How can anyone lose it? How does the brain work? What is a neuron? What is the biology behind a brain malfunction? All these and so many more questions arose in my mind, and I knew there had to be a scientific explanation to what was happening to my dad.
Welcome to Science Connections. I'm your host, Eric Cross. And that was today's guest talking about her personal motivations for studying the brain. This episode, we're exploring how storytelling and science are a powerful pair with Minnie Contreras. Minnie is a neuroscience doctoral student on a mission to make science careers more accessible for children from underrepresented communities. Today, we'll talk about her research, her new co-hosting gig on Crash Course, and how a family crisis sent her hunting for answers about the mind. Please welcome to the podcast, Minnie Contreras. Thank you so much for being here. I'm excited because there's so much about you and so much you represent that resonates with like me as a teacher and the students that I serve. We've been doing the Draw a Scientist activity. Are you familiar with that?
Yes. How's it going?
Great, but I'm not glad it's going great because of the reason why we do the Draw a Scientist activity. You know, so the purpose behind it is to like, you know, show how students perceive scientists. We have a beautiful eclectic diversity at our school of students from all different backgrounds. But our students still see like, imagine scientists based on what they saw growing up in like cartoons and whatnot. So they draw it. We look at the data. We analyze like perceived like gender, ethnicity, hair type, or are they wearing lab coats?
Yeah.
And then they notice that there's these trends. Like we always draw the same people. Every class drew the same, basically someone that looks like Albert Einstein.
Okay.
I asked them to like, okay, everybody name a scientist that's a woman. In your tables, come up with as many as you can. And they go, we don't know any.
Yeah. That's sad.
Every once in a while, Jane Goodall gets a shout out and then Marie Curie. Like, that's it. And then for them, because something had failed them, like whether it was pop culture or education, they weren't exposed to it, right?
Yeah. It's not their fault at all.
Not at all.
It's ours.
But it feels like, for them, it feels like they feel bad. And all right, a scientist from a Spanish-speaking country, any Spanish-speaking country, like name a scientist. And they're like, what? Oh, I don't know. And so once we go through all that, we talk about, like, why is it like this? And then I show them a slide of all the scientists they probably grew up with. And I said, they're all amazing scientists, but like, do you notice the same trend that you saw? And then we create scientist posters afterwards. And so I use the I Am a Scientist website. I have a Google spreadsheet that has like 250 scientists Aww. From like all different identities, like cross sections, everything. And they get to pick. And then I have Sacnas has the scientist, Chicano, Native yes. American, Indigenous scientists. And they get to pick anybody that resonates with them.
That's awesome.
And so they do. And then I'm just going to show you right now. We're using Canva. So right now many of them, this is one of my students' poster.
Yes.
And can you see it? So you're on many of their posters because I said I was going to talk to you today. So I kind of gave them a little bit of background. And so they were all on Google. So if you started trending on Google, it's because a bunch of 12-year-olds were Googling you all day.
You're going to make me cry.
You inspired them. I showed them a clip from your Crash Course. And then I showed them a little bit about your background. And some of them went on your Story Collider.
Okay.
And they got super into it. So it's all you and the inspiration you're doing.
Let me put myself back together. That's really cool. Thank you so much for sharing that with me. Really means a lot. Really.
All right. Formal. Welcome. Thank you so much for being here. And so I kind of just want to kick off because you're at the Salk Institute in San Diego, and I'd love for us to start off and talk about some of the research that you're doing. That, like, maybe just talk about like some of the work that you've been doing at Salk.
Okay, first, thank you for inviting me. I'm super excited to be here. I'm even more excited that you're a local, and I feel like we should be best friends now. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. It's official. It's done. We're here.
Great deal. Okay. The question: What do I do for research? Right. Yeah, so I'm a PhD student, and I'm officially a PhD student in the neurosciences grad program at UCSD, but my lab is at the Salk Institute, which some of the faculty are affiliated with UCSD, and my advisor is Nicola Allen, and our lab focuses on studying astrocytes, which are these really, really cool cells in the brain that are not neurons, and they're a type of glial cell. And glia comes from the word glue, because many, many years ago, people thought their job was to just like be there to like offer this kind of like net support for neurons. But now we know that they're super important. And so what I do specifically, I'm interested in how these cells, the astrocytes, are able to regulate how our brain is able to change itself in response to experience. We know that our brain has the ability to change its connections. And it's really cool because when we're young, you must be really familiar with this because you're a seventh grade teacher and the students can pick up things pretty quick. And, you know, whether it's learning science or learning how to play an instrument, or, you know, if they're interested in learning a new language, it's a lot easier to pick up those things when you're young because your brain is a lot more plastic. So in other words, it can change a lot more than when you're an adult. So when you're an adult, all these things become harder, right? And there's a reason for that. It's not like, oh, you're done learning, you know, we're gonna like stabilize everything. The reason for that is that if the amount of plasticity that we have as young people, if we had it as adults, it wouldn't be optimal energy-wise for our brain. It would just be like a super high energy demand. So there has to be like this stage of development. We call it the critical period when plasticity is really high, where like the circuits stabilize and all of this happens with the input of sensory information. So whether it's vision or audio or whatever sensory information, as you experience the environment around you, these circuits are going to sort of understand and interpret what are the connections that they need the most, and then they're going to stick with those. And so there's still some plasticity when you're an adult, but it's not as high as when you're young. And so what I'm interested in is how these astrocytes are able to regulate change in plasticity and what is different about them that allow them to, instead of like allowing a lot of changes to happen, to be like, this is enough. We're going to put a brake on these changes and we're going to like stabilize everything. I can go on forever. Clearly.
No, this is great. Please continue.
The reason that astrocytes are in such an ideal position to regulate this thing that happens in our brain is because they literally attach their little like processes or like their little branches to synapses. And synapses is where like neuron to neuron communication happens. So they like wrap these like synapses and then they can sense what's happening there and they can regulate what's happening there. And we know that they change like with age. So I'm like super excited. I'm actually like in the process of analyzing some exciting data and hopefully it'll be exciting stuff. So that's what I do.
This is starting to make sense for a lot of reasons, because what I teach at my grade, it's seventh grade. It's right when like kind of puberty is really starting to take off.
Yep.
And dances and fads and memes and all of those things are super active. And as TikTok, like not so much now, but like a few years ago, all the dances like would come out and all the kids would like pick them up super quick.
Yeah.
And I struggle to stay up on them, but they just pick it up. Is there any correlation between like hypothetically age of seventh graders and and activity of these kind of like you were talking about these astrocytes that are hyperactive? Is there an age where it's like most active?
So yes, for different things. I guess that would be like a little bit of like the motor cortex and the auditory cortex, I would say. And I mean, everything, right? You need to see these videos in order to learn the dances. I don't know. I actually don't know the exact age where like this plasticity is heightened. It's a good question.
I'm just fascinated by like the neurodevelopment of like a teenager. And like you said, the adults would be hyperactive because it'd be, tell me if I'm summarizing this right, but like if we did that as an adult, our brains were still functioning that way, we would just be overwhelmed.
Yes.
It would just be way too much, too active. And so does it kind of taper off like as you age?
So like the synapse, like I talked about, they can like, they can literally like grow new synapses or like, you know, retract synapses. And the brain is really cool in the sense that it has like excitatory neurons and then it has inhibitory neurons. So the inhibitory neurons inhibit the excitatory neurons. And it's like this like negative feedback loop like happening all the time as you experience the environment. And so the inhibitory neurons are really important because they kind of like stop hyperexcitability in the brain. We now know that there are some diseases that are associated with changes in plasticity, like schizophrenia and autism. And a lot of these things that we're that you would expect in a healthy brain are not observed in diseased brains. And there's like changes in these levels of plasticity.
This is fascinating because as a teacher, I'm thinking about classroom management.
Yeah.
And what my young people do in class. And some of the things are so just, they're off the wall. And you ask them and they're great, loving, caring human beings. But you could just see their biology just coming out of them.
Yeah.
And I'll say, there'll be times like, hey, what are you doing right now? I'm like, I don't know. And they're just reacting to stimulus. It's just reactions. And I feel like I could see externally, like what you're discussing, like going on in their brain right now. Like, and then they, yeah, exactly. It's just like a lightning storm.
Yeah.
And then they come back as an eighth grader or a high school student, and they're completely different. It's like it's like night and day.
Yeah.
Just watching like how that development. I've been doing enough for years to kind of see this.
That's cool. I miss the seventh grade.
Yeah. It is. It's so much fun. I say they're like the skinny part of the hourglass.
Yeah.
Like where they go from like little kid to like full teenager, and they're everything is new. But you know, you gotta be a certain type of teacher for that. Like some run for the hills, but like for me, I feel like that's my spot right there. Aww. So you're currently pursuing a PhD in neuroscience. But the brain wasn't always on your radar, right? Like you were an art student prior to that. I thought this was fascinating and I want you to talk about it because as a classroom teacher, oftentimes at this age and younger, students go, I'm not a science person. I'm not a math person. I'm an art person, or I'm a science person. I'm not a creative. Very rigid as far as what kind of person you are. Yet you pivoted from this classic, like, art to science. Can you talk about like how you did that? Like what motivated you to do that?
Yes. I think one thing that I never really paid a lot of attention to is that I'm like, I feel like we must all be, right? But like me particularly, like teenage years, early 20s, I was really like into like figuring out who I was and what my passions were. And so I would try everything, right? And I was in art school actually after being in business school. So I was in business school for 3 semesters. And then I was like, it's kind of like boring. It's not really for me. So then I was like, I want to do something super creative. And then I went to film school. And then I got kind of bored. And like, as I was in film school, I was in a directing class. For me, it was like, how can you direct a person without fully understanding psychology, right? So I would start reading a lot about psychology. And at the same time, in like my family, my relationship with my father was kind of like struggling, and I was seeing in him like certain behaviors that were not typical and very, very strange. And they would just like leave me thinking a lot. And so these two things kind of like played an important role in me starting reading about the brain. And like, as I was reading about psychology, I wanted to know why, right? So like psychology tells you, you know, a lot of the studies in psychology are like correlation. So like there's an association between this behavior and this experience or things like that. But I always wanted to know why. So then that took me to read about the brain, like literally brain anatomy. And then I learned that like there are these things called genes in your DNA that kind of like regulate what happens in your cells, and that there are cells in your brain that regulate what happens in your brain, and that whatever happens in your brain regulates your behavior. And I was just like mind blown, right? So I was like, I can't stop reading about this. I want to know everything. I want to be one of the people that like figure out these things, because like clearly there were a lot of black boxes, right? And so, you know, I moved to Mexico because like school's way cheaper, and I was able to keep my job here in San Diego, but like remotely for the weekend. So that was perfect, because that like that money was enough to live. And so that's kind of like how it happened, really.
That's great. And it sounds like you were saying, because of your father's health challenges, that motivated you to become hungry, but you didn't just read a book or two. Like you went course corrected and said, I'm going to go 1,000% become a scientist. What it sounded like you were saying is that your dad's health issues really motivated you to learn more, but you didn't just learn more. Like, you went and completely course corrected your trajectory of life and said, I'm going to become a scientist and study this. Is the work that you're doing right now, does that connect to what your father experienced?
In my head, 100%. But it's very, so in science, you can call something basic science, where you're literally just trying to understand how things work. And then there's translational, where you try to take this knowledge from basic science and turn it into something that translates into, like, you know, treatment for human disease or things like that.
Right.
So
right.
What I'm doing is basic science. And actually, from the very beginning, we have a lab meeting and you get to present, like, every 2 months your progress and your research. At the beginning of the program, I would be like, so, you know, like, give my background and then be like, and then bring out schizophrenia, right? And like, how that is a plasticity, like, it's a brain disease that has a lot of plasticity alterations.
Right.
I'm passionate about it for, like, multiple reasons. And so I try to connect it many times in lab meeting. And then everyone was like, no, 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 like, you're reaching too far. But, like, I'm in a room full of scientists, right? And I'm like,
right.
I think just based on the fact that, like, I went to film school and I did all these other things with my life, I'm always like, how do I sell my story in a way that is, like, super interesting? But then in a room full of scientists, everyone wants you to be, like, very objective. So for me, it does connect, like, 100%. I'm trying to understand how plasticity works in the brain. And I know that this disease that I'm really interested about, better understanding and eventually hopefully finding a treatment for it. I know that there's, like, a high association between plasticity and the disease that I'm interested in. So even if I can't really say right now that I'm, like, curing schizophrenia, I'm definitely in my mind understanding what's, like, the things that are going wrong in the brain that allow this, you know, these types of behavior to come out in a person.
I appreciate you explaining that difference between, you said, basic science.
Yes.
And then there's the kind of, like, practical application where, like, we hear about, like, the science being done and these breakthroughs, but then there's this gap between when I could actually go to the doctor or go to the, you know, get a prescription and heal myself.
Correct.
Right? Is that kind of,
yes,
the two different worlds? Yeah. And I got really excited when you said you took all of these different backgrounds and then you applied it into this, like, boardroom or whatever, yes, of scientists. I've heard from different PhDs that it's not uncommon for people to go from, like, being a bartender and then getting inspired by, like, sea urchins and then just deciding to go and just go full course into, like, researching sea urchins. Like, that a lot of people with PhDs, like, have these eclectic backgrounds.
Yeah.
Like, it wasn't always just academia.
Yeah.
Now this is kind of like this, your story arc is starting to kind of make sense, because I wanted to pivot and talk about Crash Course, which, by the way, just as a science teacher and a former science student at one point in time, those videos, the legacy of those videos got so many of us and my students through many of their science courses. That I think was it John Green, like the original ones?
Yeah, I think it was Hank,
that was
the one that did the biology. Well, I guess I'm thinking biology, but they're both in the videos, yeah.
Yeah, they were both doing it. So I love Crash Course. I love the whole, you know, the whole YouTube channel. And I was excited to find out that you and Dr. Sammy Ramsey,
yes,
are going to be co-hosting the new biology course. And you're delivering the lessons in Spanish, of which I played in my class, by the way, today for my students.
Ooh.
And then the room got silent and they were just listening to it. And some of my students point at the screen. They go, I show this to my sister. I show this to my sister. They're like losing their minds.
That's awesome.
You're already busy doing PhD research.
Yes.
How did you get involved in this, and why was this important to you to do?
Yeah. So I'll start with the second question. So I went to undergrad in Mexico for financial reasons, like I explained earlier. And I think there, more than here, the divide between, like, a scientist and the general public, when I started in school and I started learning all these things, it not only, like, taught me all the basic things that I needed for my major, but it also taught me a different way of thinking about the world and the, you know, the problems that our society faces. And so to me, it became a goal to be a bridge between the general public and science. And the reason for this is because I know that science is important. I believe in the scientific process and how we use the scientific method to come to solutions. And so I was able to see that the general public doesn't really trust science. And I think the reason for that is that there's like, when you read something about science, there's like full, like there's a lot of jargon and a lot of technicalities that, I don't know, the audience seems very specific. So it became one of my goals to not only be a science communicator, but also do it in Spanish, because I'm like, I'm fully bilingual. I feel perfectly comfortable in both languages, a little bit more in Spanish than in English, but still. And so
That's awesome. I'm still trying to get English right. So praise to you for being multilingual.
So if I, like, if I can do it in English, then I'm definitely going to do it in Spanish. Cause like my family and my closest friends, everyone speaks Spanish, you know? So I just want to be the person that bridges the scientific community with the non-scientific community. And so how I got involved, I try to do it with my wife, because my wife is a medical doctor, and we try to, like, you know, make videos about health and a little bit of science and things like that. But we clearly, I mean, we didn't have the level of production that Complexly, which is a company that does Crash Course, does, I mean, has, with, like, you know, the animation team and, like, you know, I mean, this, I just learned yesterday that this project has been on the works since 2019. So, really? Yeah. So it's like, it's a crazy process, and it involves a lot of people, and it involves a lot of talented writers and script editors. And so it's a huge team behind this. And so I have a friend in my PhD program. His name is Christian. He received an email from Yale Ciencia Academy, which is this like initiative to connect Latino scientists. And they were like, Complexly reached out to them, and they were like, we need someone that has experience with, like, you know, video, or is comfortable on camera, that speaks Spanish fluently, and that is like a, you know, has a biology background, is a biology professional, preferably a scientist, and is into science communication. And so he was like, this sounds exactly like you. You need to like reach out to this person or whatever. And so I did. And they sent me a script. I read it. Like, I filmed myself reading it. And then they called me, and right away I got it. So it was really cool. And I was like, this would mean so much to me. Like, you don't know how much this would mean to me to do this with you. Like, I believe in the project, and I haven't even seen, like, all of the, you know, all of the scripts. And so I don't know. I think we just clicked, and I'm so thankful for the opportunity. I mean, it's like, it's so beautiful. Like, every time we do a video, or every time I read a new script, and then I'm allowed to, like, give my input too, right? And, like, be like, this kind of doesn't make sense to me. Or, like, I wouldn't really say this. And so it's not really a direct translation. It's also an adaptation, because we want it to be culturally relevant for, like, the Hispanic community. So it's just, I mean, it's right. A beautiful project. Yeah.
Your energy is so great in these videos. Oh, like, I'm basic Spanish, like 3-4 from high school. I'm listening to it, and even just the vibe that comes off these videos, like, you can feel. So keep doing what you're doing.
Thank you.
It's they're great.
Thank you.
Continuing with that communication theme, you're co-delivering the keynote for the next NSTA, like National Science Teacher Association, this October. And I love the session title, using stories to connect with all learners. Every year when I start teaching, the first day, I tell my story, my why of who I am, to my students. I start there. And I just kind of wanted to ask you a little bit about you choosing that topic. And is there anything about our brains, like, that have to do with stories and, like, connections at all?
Great question. First of all, it blows my mind that I'm giving a keynote for the NSTA conference. I'm like, what?
Right? Isn't that crazy? That's yes. Awesome.
Yeah, I can't believe it. I mean, I don't know. It's I'm really fortunate, and I really believe in what we're doing. So yeah, I'm glad to, like, you know, be able to tell my story for the NSTA conference. And like you said, like, telling your why is so important. What's the deal with our brains and storytelling and the way we're doing these videos and why we're using this tool to try to teach biology? Yeah, so our brains are hardwired for storytelling. And what that means, remember how I told you that, like, when you're young, all these connections are, like, you know, happening all the time, and then, like, they, like, form and dissolve and form and dissolve.
Yes.
So when I say hardwired, it means that, like, the wires have been hardened, right? Like, the wire from, like, one neuron to the other, and, like, these circuits, which is what we call them, are, like, hard now, which is, like, a, you know, it's not
like, it's like physically, like, does it actually physically harden?
No. Yeah. So that's where I was going.
Or is it like hardened, like it's like stuck? Like, yes. When you say hardened, like, what do you, okay. Yeah, okay.
So like it's stabilized, right? It's like, it's very unlikely it. That it's okay. Going to go away. And the hypothesis is that you know, we needed stories like in an evolutionary sense, because how did you warn others that there was danger? Or like, you know, there's this food that we found and like, you know, the community tried it and someone died from it. But before we had text or, you know, mass communication and when society was evolving, these stories came in really handy, just like basically for survival. When you use stories to deliver information, you kind of immediately trigger an emotional connection with the audience. And so what we're trying to do is use these tools to make biology more engaging, more relevant to what's happening now in the world, because, you know, the way you were taught biology, I don't know about you, right? But me, the way I was taught biology in high school, it was just like a bunch of facts that I needed to learn. And nobody told me that like behind all these facts, there was like so much really cool discovery that had to happen for us to understand these things. And so we believe that the way of like teaching science is ideally teaching about the scientific process and the discovery. And these discoveries are done by a bunch of scientists from like all walks of life, even, you know, although, I mean, as you know, opportunities for people from minoritized backgrounds have been lacking for some time, but now we're trying to change that. It doesn't mean that like people from minoritized backgrounds didn't have like these like scientific ideas, right? They just didn't know that that's what they were doing. Yeah. So that's what we're trying to do. And that's why we think this is like a really efficient way to teach science, because your brain is already like wired to do that. So you can use this tool that your brain is going to love and then teach these concepts that are supposed to be really hard. But then if you make them like relatable, then it's a lot easier for the students to connect with the stories and to absorb the knowledge.
In a way, you're using science to teach science.
Yeah.
You're using the science of like how our brain works to teach science, which just makes sense. But you're like, why wasn't it done that way? You know, for so long, like you're right. Like science for a lot of people was like just fact memorization.
Yes.
And when it's embedded in a story, all of a sudden, like it makes sense to us. And so many cultures revolve around or venerate stories, storytelling. And, you know, even when you sit down, you talk about something with some of my students, like I'm kind of like a bottom line, get to the point, like kind of communicator. But some of my students, when they tell stories, it's like this whole, it could just be what happened at lunch.
Yeah.
And like I ate some carrots and some ranch and that was it. But it was this whole story of like who was there, what colors, what clothes they were wearing, like all of this color in the story. But for them, like that's how they communicate. Like that's how they remember the incident, the situation and all of that. So
right. That's
exciting that you're going to be talking about that with Dr. Ramsey. I hope I could hear it because I want to go and I want to be able to listen to you. Talk about.
It'd be so great to see you there. You should go.
Yeah, I'm trying. Now you're on team no sleep, clearly, because you're doing all these things. And I got another one I want to ask you about. I don't know how you have the time to do this. You must have that gene where people can only sleep for 4 hours and they're fully refreshed.
I don't have that. I need my sleep. Sleep is important.
You don't have that? Okay. Okay. I just want to check. I always envy those people. My students swear that it's them because they go to bed late and wake up early and they're fine. But
tell them they need their sleep. Sleep is really important, especially like at their age. They should get their sleep.
I try. Can you tell me about your directing role at Colors of the Brain? So is KIBM Undergrad Scholars Research Program. That is a whole other thing.
Yes.
That you got going on. What are you doing with that initiative? What is that?
Okay. So it started as a grad student organization in 2016 by other grad students in the program. And I joined the program in 2019. And at this point we were like a mentoring organization of a bunch of grad students trying to like demystify the journey into a PhD program for undergraduates. And this initiative was, you know, particularly designed to help and, you know, historically excluded and marginalized populations in neuroscience specifically. So as we were mentoring all these kids, young adults, all the undergrads, we noticed.
I do the same thing. And yeah, I say the same thing. Yeah. And some of my first students are like 34 years old and I still call them kids. And I go, I'm so sorry. You're still 12 in my mind.
Yeah. Well, if you're a student, you're a kid. So I don't know. I'm going to be a student for the rest of my life. So I'll be a kid for the rest of my life, hopefully.
That's fair.
So when we were mentoring these kids, one of the things, if you want to get into a PhD program, you need to have research experience because, mm-hmm. I mean, especially nowadays. Back in the day, like, I don't know, some PhD programs probably like admitted you without having research experience, because doing a PhD is a training thing. So you are learning how to do science independently. It's like a training program, right? So even though like you do reach some level of independence, you're a trainer. And so nowadays they're so competitive and you do have to have research experience. And so we had some undergrads that like, you know, they were first generation or came from historically excluded and marginalized populations, and they never knew about science or research. Like me, I didn't know that you could be a scientist for like a professional career. And I didn't know what that meant, right? Yeah, they don't know. So they, and then all of a sudden they take a neurobiology course and they're like, this is so cool. Like, I want to do this. And, but at the time they're already juniors or like even seniors, right? So we noticed that like all these kids that are coming to realize that they could be really interested in scientific research are coming kind of like late in the game, and they don't have all the bullet points checked out that like a privileged kid would have. So we created this summer research program where we fund them, because the other thing is like all of these kids, there's like a high correlation with like having a financial need and like belonging to these populations. So we fully fund them, and we're supported by the KIBM, which is the Kavli Institute for Brain and Mind. They give us the money to be able to pay the undergrads, and then we put them in labs. And what's really cool about it is that like we direct it. So like we're a big group of grad students. It's not just me. There's like 13 leadership roles. And so we get funding from KIBM, and we're able to pay the undergrads to do full-time research for 10 weeks over the summer. And then a lot of them, they've never been in a lab before, but like we pair them with 3 different grad mentors. So that's us, the PhD students, and sometimes postdocs. And we like answer questions for them. We tell them like what the deal is, like what's the hidden curriculum. We give them advice. We, you know, based on their research interests, we're like, oh, these 2 or 3 labs would be really cool for you. Have a talk with the PI. And then because they're fully funded, it's very likely that the PIs are going to be like, oh, a PI is like the head of the lab, the professor.
Okay.
It's just very likely that they're going to say yes. But the other cool thing is that we tailor the list of the faculty that we offer for them to join in their lab, because we want faculty that are going to be mentoring these kids to be faculty that have like a track record of being supportive of like historically excluded and marginalized communities. So it's like a whole thing. I'm like super passionate about it too, because I believe in like offering these undergrads an opportunity that otherwise they might have not found without our program. Of course, all of this comes from you know, my passion to like make science more accessible to these communities.
There were so many things that you said in that description that I want, that I feel like I could talk about. But did you say the words hidden curriculum?
Yes.
That by itself opens up a whole other can of worms. And then you're also addressing this kind of, this reminds me of like those jobs that say entry level, but you need 5 years of experience.
Yes.
And you're like, what? Or the whole internship thing, but it's unpaid.
Yep.
Like all of these kind of things that exist. And then you're also partnering people with mentors who not only have credentials in the right fields, but they have the experience and the heart and the skills and the empathy connected piece. They can resonate with the humanity of this up and coming scientist. And so it's the way I hear it, it's almost like you reverse engineered what people wish they would have had.
Yes.
And then kind of almost create a program out of it. Am I hearing you right?
Yeah, 100%. That's exactly what we do. And that's what we tell them. You know, we're like, they're undergrads and they see us as, you know, the directors or like the leaders in the program. And they like, they want to see us almost as professors. And we're like, no. Like we were exactly where you were like 4 or 5 years ago. We know what the deal is. You can trust us. We know what it's like to be you in this situation. And we want to be here for you. And so like all those things that you feel like it's not safe to tell your professors, you can tell us. And we're going to solve this together because we went through it. Right? We know what it's like to not know what you're doing. And we're here to show you that you can be successful no matter what your background is, no matter what the difficulties of your life have been, no matter like, you know, what your racial background or your socioeconomic status, you can do it. And if you're passionate about this, we believe in you and we're going to give you all the tools to succeed.
You got me ready to open this link and like sign up right now. Like I was like, can I go back and do this? Like, I want to be in this program. That's amazing.
Yes, you can. Come join us.
I'm only a little bit kidding. I love my students. I love my students. I'm not going anywhere. Don't worry.
Okay, good.
Mr. Cross, in the podcast, you said this. My students listen. They do. And they come back and they tell me. They give me feedback. Like little 12-year-old feedback. It's amazing. Okay, so I'm taking notes and I'm writing down just these identities that you occupy. And here's what I've written. Like, you're, first of all, like, you're this amazing scientist. You're a content creator. You're an amazing person, like human being, like who you are as a person.
Thank you.
You're also Mexican, female, member of the LGBTQ community. All of that to say you've changed what my students perceive a scientist to look like. Mm. How does it feel to be a role model?
It's really
like,
cool.
You're supposed to be on the spot right
there. It gets me a little bit emotional, honestly. I mean, I didn't do this to like become a role model, obviously. I mean, I entered this space and I recognized that there were not a lot of people that looked like me or were like me or came from, you know, a background similar to mine. So in that sense, I knew it was important to stay true to myself. And, you know, being in an academic space, there's like a very strong tendency that you have to fight. I mean, we're social beings. We want to fit in all the time. And instead of like you becoming a person that imitates the norm in those spaces that we know, like, you know, what the majority is and what the majority looks like, it's really important to stay true to yourself because you never know like who's looking at you, right? And if they see you staying true to yourself and, you know, wearing all these flags that you talked about, then it's inspiring, right? And then it tells them that there's a space for them here too, even though it may not look like it. We're working on it. It's important to like stay true to yourself and demonstrate that there's room for you. And if there are like some systemic barriers for sure, but when I came in, I wanted to like find a role model that like looked like me, right? And that was hard. Mm-hmm. And so what I had to do was instead of trying to find someone that checked all these minority boxes that I check, focus maybe on one, right? So like a woman scientist. And then I was able to perceive that like you can connect with people on that level too. So even if there's people that like are not fully like you are, you come to realize that you're not as different, right? And so, I mean, it's not us that you have to convince. It's clearly the system, but you know, we're working on it. So it's hard to believe that I'm a role model. It feels amazing and it really means a lot. And I do feel very much responsible to like exist in this space, staying true to myself and just continue making this space more accessible for people like me.
That's awesome to hear. I can tell you as somebody who's in the classroom, and this is just the voice of many other classroom teachers, is that while you're doing all of this work, oftentimes we don't get to hear the impact that the work that we're trying to do or the impact that what we represent has on the minds and hearts of young people, but it does. And I get to see it. A friend of mine and I that I've interviewed in the podcast before, Dr. Desiree Whitmore, she's a physicist. She's at the Exploratorium. She's an amazing friend. And she was one of the first people that I met that made me feel comfortable in my own skin, having my identities as an academic, as a teacher, but then also this biracial guy who grew up in Southeast San Diego, who has this other part of his identity that isn't always represented in academia. You know, if I'm coming in, you know, in street clothes or the music I'm listening to, or if I'm code switching, there were times in my life where I feel like I had to suppress that aspect of who I am,
right?
Because it just didn't feel like, it didn't feel good to show it. But I also feel like I was holding back who I was.
Right.
And it wasn't until I started making those friends or seeing folks that have really got after it, but then were also, like you said, true to themselves.
Yeah.
I love what you said about the person didn't have to kind of like check off all the same boxes that you have in your identity, but the fact that they were true to themselves in general, that's kind of contagious. At least I felt it was.
Yes.
Like they're real. They're 100% them. And it's not the norm. So I could be me.
Yes.
In this, and that's okay. And I can empower my students to do the same. Like that feels good to be able to do that.
Yes, 100%.
I want to go back to young version of you. Ooh. So we're going to just kind of like, as we roll down, like to school days. You mentioned this earlier. You said like a lot of biology and science was kind of like memorization. When you were in kind of maybe think kindergarten through maybe high school, was science for you as a student? What was that like?
I have like really bad recollection of when I was really young. So I went to school in Mexico all the way through ninth grade. And then I came here for high school.
Can I ask what part of Mexico that you went to school for, you were in?
Right across the border, Tijuana. And that's okay, where I grew up. Yeah. So science, maybe we had like a couple hours a week, like in elementary school primarily. And I remember like thinking it was fun, but it wasn't, I don't know, like it, you know, I don't know. I wasn't really a kid that, like, I guess I wanted to be a veterinarian. How do you say that? Veterinarian. Yes. Veterinaria.
Yeah. Like animals.
Yes. So my mom tells me that, and that's like, you know, what do you want to be when you grow up? But my reason was that I love dogs. So it wasn't really like scientifical, but I remember like, I thought it was fun, and it was kind of like the, you know, like it kind of like in my head, it fit into the category of like PE and like arts and music and like science. It's like, you know, like the fun class, but like, I didn't really think like back then that like you could do that for a living, you know? So I don't know. I guess I thought it was just like the knowledge that you needed to like pass exams and like graduate school or something. I don't know. Or like, I wish I had like an origin story of like those, like the scientists that are like, oh yeah, like I was 7 years old and like I saw this. I don't know. You know, I don't really have that.
It's funny you say that because I totally empathize with like the origin story, because we never feel like we have our own, even though yours is incredibly powerful as an outsider that listens to it. Mm-hmm. But one of the things as a classroom teacher, that what you said validates me, is that you remember how you felt about science.
Right.
You remember the emotional impact. You remember that was fun. Yeah. And as simple as that is, if you had a memory that it wasn't, or that it was bad, or you had a negative impact on it, that you might not have gone into the field that you went into, like, possibly.
That's true. Yes.
If it was a bad experience.
Yeah.
And so there were at least enough experiences where you left those early years of education that were positive for you.
Yes.
And that, and also that you felt empowered enough that you could pivot from, you know, doing art and going into to becoming a neuroscientist. And that, even that in what you said, like you said you don't have an origin story, but like that alone is powerful, because oftentimes as educators, like, you're figuring out like what are the things that matter most in teaching.
Yeah.
There's a lot of things that we have to teach, and we only have a short amount of time, but those experiences for your students when they leave, because you never know who's going to be the next person that goes on and makes the next discovery. You don't know how your little segment of this 9 months or 10 months that you have them, how that's going to shape who they become later on.
100%.
And so yeah. I love what you said.
Yeah. I mean, you have such an important job. And I think listening to your podcast and like, you know, the fact that you do this, it's really cool that like your students have you, and that you care so much about like figuring out like what science teaching is, more so than like the curriculum and like what that means. And I can tell that like you have like a goal in life to like inspire these kids and communicate science in a way that is just not a class, but kind of like, you know, something that influences your life forever. And I know they're going to keep you in their hearts forever. Like, you're just kind of like that kind of teacher. Like, I have teachers that like I remember with like great love, you know, just because they had like an important impact on me.
Can I ask you, just, is there anybody that that stands out to you that you remember? I know you said your memory isn't that great, but is there any like class or any important time or to specific teacher you remember that like just comes to mind?
Yeah, I had a I think she was my fifth year teacher. She was like, I don't know, she kind of like believed in me in like a weird way. There was like this like a state competition of like a test that you can take that like they had like Spanish, which is kind of like English, so the same like Spanish, and like math, and I think it was like history, like Mexican history. And she was like, oh, you can totally do this, like, you know, we're gonna sign you up. And I wasn't like, you know, like a straight A student or anything, and like she signed me up. I didn't study for it at all, but like she would invite me to her house to like to study and like prepare for the test. And instead I would just like, her kid was also in my class, and so we would just play all day and like never actually studied. And then I took the test and like they didn't even tell me how I did, because I think I did that terrible. But it wasn't like studying for the test. It was just the fact that like she believed that I could do something amazing, and the fact that like she wanted to connect with me on like a more personal level was just really cool. It was, I don't know, like it taught me that like teachers are humans too, you know, like at a super early age. It gets so crazy that like when you're a little kid, you see like teachers as like weird parts of life that are not really human. So like every teacher that like, humanizes a teacher is like, is very much appreciated. Isn't that true though? Like,
it's so true. It is true. Yeah. This is exactly why I tell my story. Like, it's 100% true. They think like we live in our classroom, and then we just go into a closet, and like that's where we are. And they see us in public, yeah. and it's like they see like for me it's like a Sasquatch, because I'm tall. I know you can't see from here, but it's like they're seeing like some kind of mythical creature when they see us in the wild.
What?
So no, yeah, it is. It's true. It's like like you see them at like a Costco or you see them at an ice cream shop or a grocery store or something, yeah. and they see you and their eyes get really big. And depending on the type of student it is, if they're with their parent,
yeah.
like they'll try to avoid you or they'll get excited. And, you know, parents, they always want to talk about, you know, how's my kid, all those kind of things. So you have this impromptu teacher conference. But yeah, it's really funny when they see us outside of our context. They're like, shouldn't you be at school? My brother, it's Saturday. Like, I got to eat too.
That's so funny. I don't know what that is. It's interesting though. Yeah.
It hasn't changed. It hasn't changed all those years. Do you have any feelings on like how you'd like to see science be taught? Like from how you experienced it to like now knowing what you know, is there anything that you would change or include or add or modify?
So in the videos for Crash Course Biology and Biología, we mention a lot of scientists that are not like the typical scientists that like everyone knows, right? So it'd be really cool to include them and what they did and how they came to their discoveries. I would love if teachers just include it like, okay, this is a cell and this is the nucleus, and in the nucleus there's DNA and DNA is important. Like, how do we know that? It's just so cool the way that we learn that like genes are like what regulates like everything that happens in your body, and like how like Rosalind Franklin had a big like was super involved in the discovery of the structure of DNA, and like at first no one talked about her, and like because she was a woman working in a men's lab, you know, and little things like that. And I think that like if the students heard those things behind like all the stories that like are behind the scientific facts that we know and we teach in school, they would just be like way more interested, and they would, I feel like they would be more memorable. So if you do that, thank you for doing that.
So I'm hearing that storytelling element kind of what you're talking yes. about being integrated into and 100%. Some of these stories are wild. Like even we do the phenothiocarbamide PTC paper. Uh-huh. I don't know if you remember that one. You just taste it to see if you're a super taster.
Yeah.
And the story behind it is two researchers were working with the chemical for some other reason, and it blew in one of their faces, and they tasted it and they go, this is bitter. And the other guy tasted it and goes, no, it's not. And then it made them start wondering like what caused this? And I tell my students, I said, look, don't go eating things and trying things to like have new discoveries in science. Like don't, many people who've tried that and they didn't write down any data because you can run any experiment once and then they sit there and they go, wait,
yeah.
But yeah, you're right. There are all kinds of these wild stories that are really interesting. They could be like a Netflix special.
Yeah.
You know how these things were discovered.
Yeah. Related to like the tasting thing. My enzymology professor in Mexico gave us like these pills that block your acid receptors in your tongue. And so
Miracle berries.
I guess. I don't know what they were called. But like, and then he would give us like lemon, and it was so weird because it was so like sweet, you know? And like, yeah, I mean, I remember these things. I probably don't remember like the science behind it, but I mean, yeah, they block your receptors. So.
But you remember eating a lemon and it tasting sweet, yes. and you're like, what was that? How did that work? How did you hack into my taste buds just
yeah.
now?
Yeah. It's just really cool. Yeah.
Minerva, thank you so much, one, for making the time to be here. I know you're super busy. Thank you for the work that you're doing and sharing your story, and for all the additional things that you're doing and thinking about like where you come from, the students, the people that are looking at you, and just bulldozing this pathway for the people that are going to come behind you, who are my students. And this is literal because we're in the same city. Like. You are making like trailblazing this pathway for them and inspiring them. And you will do so for years to come, because, you know, if you got some time, maybe you can come visit my students in the classroom because they'd love to meet you. No pressure.
Thank you so much for having me. And I would love that so much. Let's make it happen. I would love to visit you.
All right. Everybody heard it. Everyone heard it. We recorded it.
Let's do it.
All right. Awesome.
I had a great time. Thank you so much.
Thanks so much for listening to my conversation with Minnie Contreras, doctoral student in neuroscience at the Salk Institute in San Diego and director of Colors of the Brain. Check out the show notes for links to the resources Minnie and I discussed. And we'd love to know what you thought of this episode in our Facebook discussion group, Science Connections, the Community. For more tips and strategies, visit amplify.com/sciencewebinars and sign up for one of our sessions, including the upcoming Science Connections webinar in October. And if you're going to NSTA, make sure you catch Minnie's keynote and visit Amplify at booth 192. you might just see me there. Thanks again for listening. Hey, Science Connections listeners, it's Eric again. Before we go, I want to let you know a few exciting updates. First, this episode wraps up our third season, which has been all about making the case for science in a world where science is often the underdog. We talked about everything from integrating science and literacy.
If a science teacher wants to know, do their students really understand the concepts? Have them write.
To modeling responsible use of ChatGPT.
The kid graduates from school without knowing that AI exists. They're not going to be prepared for what they face out in the world.
And if you missed any episodes in the series, please scroll back in your feed. There's so many great ideas and strategies for bringing more science into your classroom and school. Later next month, we'll be back with a special new episode of the Science Connections podcast. Also, be on the lookout for a few other exciting projects we've got in the works. The first is a brand new back-to-school toolkit for science educators. This toolkit is jam-packed with resources to help kickstart a great year in the classroom. And it may include a cover letter from yours truly. You'll have to check it out. Finally, later this fall, we'll be launching a new webinar series. I'll be talking to some amazing science educators and thinkers, including some names that you may recognize from past podcast episodes. This will be your chance to hear from them again and ask some of your questions. Stay up to date on all these exciting things at amplify.com/science-connections. That's amplify.com/science-connections. Hope to see you soon.